What will we make of it?
So Franklin Roosevelt was dead, and the presidency had fallen to a man who had no deep experience in foreign or military affairs or diplomacy. Roosevelt had never had an extended talk with Vice President Truman on Germany or on any other aspect of the post-war world. And for all but 25 of Truman's 82 days as vice president, the president had been away on his trips to Yalta, Hyde Park, and Warm Springs. As always, Roosevelt had expected to remain in the driver's seat. If he had any idea of leaving the presidency before 1949, he certainly did not expect it to happen by sudden death, while sitting in Warm Springs with his paramour and 100 crucial decisions to make before World War II was won. For 4.5 years, while fighting a world war, Roosevelt had kept the strings of leadership under his tight control. If he alienated a Stimson, Hull, or Morgenthau, he had always been certain that he could bring them back into the fold. If he cavalierly signed a Quebec memorandum or a draft directive on Germany that gave him trouble, he could deny recalling he had ever signed it. And if there were complaints in Dewey's speeches or Stimson's diary about his chaotic administrative methods and his mercurial indecision, no matter. From Roosevelt's point of view, he knew, while concealing his motives and actions, exactly what he wanted to do. Roosevelt had once boasted to Morgenthau, "I'm a juggler, and I never let my right hand know what my left hand does." But now the juggler had fallen dead. With his sudden absence, just before the climax of World War II, the whirling bowling pins, canes, and china plates were in immediate danger of crashing down. As the historian Robert Farrell has written, Roosevelt had created a Rube Goldberg machine, and when he died, he had left his successor no operator's manual. Thus, on Friday morning, April 13, 1945, when President Harry Truman sat down behind Roosevelt's maple Oval Office desk, he was befuddled. About Germany and World War II, Truman had no idea what Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin had said or agreed to. Surrounded by Roosevelt's naval prints and ship models, Truman asked an aide to put away the gewgaws and ornaments that littered the massive desk. Then he called in Edward Stettinius, who was now his Secretary of State. Truman once wrote a cousin that after he came to Washington, FDR and nearly everybody else had thought of him as the representative of the devil in the person of Tom Pendergast, the Kansas City political boss who had advanced Truman's career. Now, even the polished Stettinius, who so prided himself on getting along with everyone, privately thought of Truman as a small-time courthouse politician. Truman reminded Stettinius of the rapscallions who surrounded the scandalous Warren Harding. Now, while briefing Truman on the war, Stettinius told him about the decree that Roosevelt had approved in late March. He reported that the Big Three had yet to agree on Germany's treatment under occupation. He warned Truman, since Yalta, the Soviets have taken a firm and uncompromising position on nearly every major question. After Stettinius left the Oval Office, Truman saw Stimson and the Chiefs of Staff. Privately, Truman considered Stimson the best member of Roosevelt's cabinet. During the war, in the Senate, Truman had begun to examine the mysterious new defense installation at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Unbeknownst to Truman, that was where an atomic bomb was being created. Stimson went to Senator Truman and said this was one of the most important things in the history of the world. He persuaded Truman to call off your dogs. Now Stimson warned Truman of alarming last-ditch German resistance. He said there was a danger that Hitler and his forces might retreat to a mountain redoubt. That might delay victory in Europe for 6 months. Truman was unfazed. He praised the War Department's performance and told Stimson to keep it up. After the meeting, Stimson and General Marshall rode back to the Pentagon. Marshall said, "We won't really know what Truman is like until the pressure begins to be felt." But later on, Stimson wrote in his diary that he felt wonderful relief. After 5 years serving Roosevelt, Stimson appreciated Truman's promptness and snappiness. In his diary, he wrote, "No long, drawn-out soliloquies." Morgenthau wrote his sons that Roosevelt's death had hit him awfully hard. He was exhausted from sleepless nights worrying about his wife. He was deprived of her shrewd advice on Washington personalities. On Sunday morning, April 14, he strode into Truman's Oval Office. He had the condescending air of someone there to assess a man who is his new boss only in title. During the years when Truman was an obscure, backbench provincial senator, known largely for his origins in the Pendergast machine, Morgenthau had been the president's chief crony in the cabinet and one of the lions of the New Deal. Morgenthau presumed that the new president respected and needed him as much or more than Roosevelt had. But in this, he was badly mistaken. As it turned out, Truman had resented him since an incident years before. Morgenthau may never have even known about it, but the new president remembered the incident with lingering bitterness. The incident came after Truman's first election to the Senate in 1934. The senior Missouri senator, Bennett Clark, took him for a courtesy call on the Secretary of the Treasury. The two men were told by a Morgenthau aide that the secretary was not in. Hypersensitive about his ties to Pendergast, Truman was certain that Morgenthau had snubbed him. Despite his surface civility, Truman saw Morgenthau as a Roosevelt errand boy who had exploited his presidential friendship to wander into areas beyond his domain, intellect, and experience, such as the treatment of post-war Germany. From reading the newspapers and chatting over bourbon and branch water with old congressional friends, Truman had been appalled by the public tempest over the Morgenthau plan. He blamed Morgenthau for overstepping his bounds and Roosevelt for his favoritism and sloppy administrative methods. Truman's approach to administration was as crisp as his double-breasted suits. Truman also disliked the messy public struggles of all against all that Truman believed had afflicted too much of Roosevelt's war leadership. Years later, Truman recalled, Roosevelt wasn't an administrator. He simply liked to play one outfit against the other. Now that he was president, Truman was determined to make sure that the chief cabinet posts were held by people he trusted enough to give considerable autonomy. Truman's sense of political self was not threatened but enhanced by the prospect of having strong people in his cabinet. He wrote, "I am willing and want to pass the credit around. The objective is the thing, not personal aggrandizement." But Morgenthau knew none of Truman's private feelings and was taken in by his self-deprecating manner. As a result, Morgenthau treated his new boss as if the purpose of their first conversation was for Truman to convince Morgenthau that he was up to Morgenthau's exacting standards. As Morgenthau later wrote in his diary, on that Saturday morning in the Oval Office, he found it difficult to address Truman as Mr. President. Morgenthau quickly tried to claim his turf. He told Truman he had been doing a lot of things which Mr. Roosevelt has encouraged me to do that aren't exactly Treasury business. He said, "I'd like to talk to you sometime about Germany and explain the Morgenthau plan." Politely, Truman replied, "I would like to know about it." Then, remembering Morgenthau's public wrestling matches over Germany, he added sourly, "I don't want any fussing between you and Stettinius." Defensively, Morgenthau replied, "I get along with all members of the cabinet." He said, "There are no problems with Stettinius and me, only with the people under him." Morgenthau warned Truman, "The big financiers will want to get rid of me. Unless the President of the United States stands right behind me, I won't last 2 minutes." Truman said, "I want you to stay with me." Morgenthau said, "I'll stay just as long as I think I can serve you." Truman said, "When the time comes that you can't, you will hear from me first, direct." After the conversation, Morgenthau wrote his sons that the new president had been very good. He wrote, "Truman is very snappy, wants quick answers, and I think he is going to give some of the cabinet members heart failure because they have been accustomed to taking things pretty easy." At Hyde Park on Sunday morning, April 15, a bugler played taps as Franklin Roosevelt's coffin was lowered into the garden beside his family house. Morgenthau wrote his sons, "It was a brilliant, clear spring day, and the flowers around the grave stood out like so many jewels. They had the West Point cadets and they had the Marines, and when they finally blew taps, it got me. Morgenthau reported that his daughter Joan cried like a baby. The next afternoon, Monday, April 16, Truman addressed a joint session of Congress. He reaffirmed Roosevelt's war policies. He said, "Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender." Privately, Truman was skeptical even of this keystone of Roosevelt's war leadership. Much later, he told aides, "It probably would have been better had there been no policy of unconditional surrender." Truman argued that without Roosevelt's unflinching demand, the Germans might have surrendered when they felt certain to be defeated, perhaps after Stalingrad or the D-Day landings. To Truman, this would have saved lives and allowed a much easier recovery for all of Europe, and especially Germany. On Wednesday, April 18, the hundreds of thousands of German troops in the Ruhr Pocket threw up their hands. It was the largest such surrender of the European War. Crossing the Elbe River, the 9th U.S. Army had pushed within 50 miles of Berlin. With U.S. forces so close, General Patton reopened the question of racing the Soviets to the capital. "We had better take Berlin," he told Eisenhower, "and quick." Eisenhower refused. He noted that the 50,000 Ninth Army soldiers beyond the Elbe were outside the range of fighter plane support. He said, "We'd get all coiled up for something that in all probability would never come off." More worried about Stalin's motives every hour, Churchill agreed with Patton. On Truman's behalf, Eisenhower calmed Churchill down, but the Prime Minister had larger stakes in mind. By this moment, almost 70 American divisions had rushed into Germany faster than the Red Army. One reason was that many of the Russian soldiers had to move on foot and by primitive horse-drawn vehicles. As a result, American forces had thrust 150 miles into the Soviet occupation zone. Many Germans, afraid of the Soviets, were straining to surrender to the Americans. Churchill thought this vital leverage that the Anglo-Americans should not give up without getting some concessions from Stalin. On the day of the surrender in the Ruhr Pocket, Churchill cabled Truman that when Roosevelt and he had drawn up occupation zones for Germany rather hastily at Quebec, they had not foreseen that Eisenhower's armies would make such a mighty inroad into Germany. Churchill wrote he was quite prepared to keep the deal with Stalin about zones, but he said, "Anglo-American troops should not be hustled back by some crude assertion of a local Russian general." Truman did not buy Churchill's proposal. As he recalled years later, he felt that if he and Churchill started breaking their promises, they wouldn't get anywhere with Stalin. He wrote Churchill instead that the only practical thing to do was to try our best to make the Russians carry out their agreements. Truman and Churchill wrote Stalin that their troops would indeed retreat to their assigned zones in Germany as soon as the military situation permits. That week, the entire world was discovering the hell of the concentration camps. British tanks crashed through the gates of Belsen, the first large death mill to be liberated. Skeletal women and men staggered to their feet as British soldiers cried through bullhorns, "You are free! You are free! You are free!" From another liberated camp, Edward R. Murrow told Americans over CBS radio, "I pray you believe what I have said about Buchenwald." Harold Ickes told his diary that the American public would now really assert itself against the Germans. He wrote, "The pictures and the descriptions that have appeared in the newspapers are simply horrifying. Since the Germans have been guilty of these atrocities, I am in favor of their disclosure because otherwise we can't possibly have the state of mind that we ought to have in agreeing upon terms for Germany." Even now, however, Henry Stimson could not comprehend the historic enormity of the death camps. In his diary, he kept on referring to the so-called atrocities. Rabbi Stephen Wise hoped that the shock and outrage that Americans were feeling could be harnessed on behalf of the old dream of a Jewish state in Palestine. On Friday morning, April 20, in the Oval Office, Wise told President Truman, I'm not sure if you're aware of the reasons underlying the wish of the Jewish people for a homeland. Truman promised Wise he would try to help. On his desk was a stiff memo from the State Department warning that the Palestine issue was highly complex. Years later, Truman recalled the memo from the Striped Pants Boys, telling me to watch my step, saying that I really didn't understand what was going on over there and that I should leave it to the experts. By Truman's account, his attitude was, as long as I was president, I'd see to it that I made policy. Still, after a later visit from Wise, Truman scrawled in his diary that the rabbi's purpose was to put me on the spot with the Jews. Night after night, Truman stayed up late in Roosevelt's old map room in the White House basement. He wore his eyes out, poring over the secret diplomatic documents that Roosevelt had never allowed him to see. Years later, Truman told his aides, I had to be in an intelligent position to make these decisions. I had never seen the map room before I became president. I didn't know it existed. Truman was startled by the growing hostility of Stalin's messages to Roosevelt in Warm Springs. As he recalled, Stalin accused us of everything under the sun, that we were trying to make a separate peace with Germany. On Sunday evening, April 22, Stalin's foreign minister, Molotov, came to the White House. As Truman recalled, Molotov had a Cro-Magnon head like an apple. As he recalled, when Molotov began to tell me what the Russians had to have, Truman replied that there were two sides to the question. Molotov said, I have never been talked to like that in my life. Truman said, carry out your agreements and you won't get talked to like that. In Moscow, U.S. Ambassador Averell Harriman regretted that Truman went at it so hard. He felt that Truman's behavior gave Molotov an excuse to tell Stalin that Roosevelt's policies were being abandoned. With Hitler in his bunker and Allied bombs raining down on Berlin, Heinrich Himmler was furtively offering Truman and Churchill a separate peace. Himmler was one of Hitler's top men, but now he had secretly turned against the Führer. As Truman later recalled, the German idea was to split the three great powers. On Wednesday, April 25, Truman went to the Pentagon to discuss Himmler's offer with Churchill. They communicated over a secure transatlantic line. As Truman later recalled, Churchill was very anxious for a surrender, and he was very much afraid that the Russians would make a separate peace with Hitler. But Truman insisted that Himmler be forced to surrender to all three governments. Churchill consented. Stalin cabled Truman and Churchill that their reply to Himmler's peace feeler had been absolutely sound. He said, as for us Russians, we pledge to continue our attacks on the Germans. Stimson wrote in his diary that victory in Europe would soon be here. He wrote, it is hard to think of it. All the toil, energy, and strain, all the blood and tears. He wrote, the world has been brought to the very brink of ruin, and now, complete victory. What will we make of it?
I was never in favor of that crazy plan.
Before dawn on Sunday, April 29, 1945, Soviet tanks rumbled near Hitler's bunker in Berlin. Soviet shells made the ceiling tremble. Inside the catacomb, the Führer perfunctorily married his mistress, Eva Braun. Then he called in a secretary and dictated his last political testament. Hitler said, I will not fall into the hands of an enemy that requires a new spectacle exhibited by the Jews to divert its hysterical masses. My wife and I choose to die in order to escape the shame of overthrow or capitulation. The next day, the Führer of the Thousand-Year Reich shot himself in the head. His new wife swallowed poison. By Hitler's orders, the two bodies were taken upstairs into the garden, doused with gasoline, and set afire, with Hitler's shin bone suddenly visible through the flames. At the White House, Truman was surprised to learn that Hitler had killed himself. Truman had expected many high German officers to take this way out, he said, but Hitler, in his fanaticism, to resist to the very end. Accustomed to mistrust what they heard from Nazi Germany, 68% of Americans questioned whether Hitler was really dead. A Michigan animal trainer named Spikehorn Meyer wired Truman, "I am offering $50,000 cash, American money, for the capture of Adolf Hitler delivered to me. I want to make Hitler a sideline attraction with my bear show, and I will tour Russia, England, and other Allied countries." On Sunday, May 6, Eisenhower cabled Truman that General Alfred Jodl and Admiral Hans von Friedeberg of the German High Command had arrived at his headquarters in France. Jodl and Friedeberg were trying to strike a separate peace with the Anglo-Americans. Eisenhower told Truman that the Germans had been warned that unless they agreed to my terms of surrender, he would break off all negotiations and seal the Western Front. On Monday, May 7, 1945, the surrender instrument was signed by Jodl. He was followed by General Walter Bedell Smith for the Anglo-Americans and General Ivan Suslaparov for the Soviet High Command. Jodl declared, "With this signature, the German people and armed forces are, for better or worse, delivered into the victors' hands." He said he hoped that the victors will treat them with generosity. Then Jodl was taken into Eisenhower's office. Eisenhower warned Jodl that he would be held responsible if surrender terms were violated. Then he had Jodl dismissed. Eisenhower now declared that the formula of unconditional surrender, declared by Roosevelt and Churchill in January 1943, has now been fulfilled. The next morning, Tuesday, May 8, was Truman's 61st birthday. He told the nation by radio that our rejoicing over victory in Europe was sobered by the terrible price we have paid to rid the world of Hitler and his evil band. Much later, Truman recalled, "It's a pity that Roosevelt could not have survived the German surrender in his former physical and mental condition." Truman said, "The entire settlement would have been made much easier. Roosevelt had world opinion with him. No one else had that glamour in all the countries that he had." Truman said, "I didn't know whether I could pick up the threads where he left them." Unlike Roosevelt, Truman had no boyhood memories of Germany. But also unlike Roosevelt, he had actually fought the Germans in battle. Truman was past draft age when Congress declared war in 1917. But he was stirred by Woodrow Wilson's pledge to make the world safe for democracy. As a result, at the age of 33, Truman faked his vision test to join the Army. Before training at Camp Donovan, Oklahoma, Truman wrote his fiancée, Bess Wallace, "If we are ordered to go to Berlin, go we must or be buried on the way." He said, "I'd like to be present when Berlin falls. If the war ends happily and I can steal the Russian or German crown jewels, just think what a grand military wedding you can have." After the November armistice, Truman wrote Bess that he might have to join the occupation. When President Wilson came to Paris to make the peace, Truman saw him climb into his car in front of the Hotel Crillon. But like other U.S. servicemen, Truman was dreaming of home. He wrote Bess, "I don't give a whoop, to put it mildly, whether there's a League of Nations or whether Russia has a red government or a purple one. And if the president of the Czechoslovaks wants to pry the throne from under the king of Bohemia, let him pry, but send us home." In the mid-1930s, Truman deferred to his isolationist Missouri constituency. He voted for neutrality laws that kept the United States from aiding European democracies against fascism. But when Roosevelt called for preparedness, Truman responded. In the fall of 1940, he went to General Marshall and said he wanted to enlist. Marshall said, "You're too damned old. You'd better stay home and work in the Senate." After Hitler's invasion of Poland, Truman wrote his wife that he was mighty blue. He said he doubted that England and France can lick the Germans and Russians. "If Germany can organize Russia and make England give up her fleet, look out. We'll have a Nazi or nasty world." Truman was less willing than Roosevelt to draw moral distinctions between the Nazis and the Stalinists. Even when Americans joined forces with the Soviets after Pearl Harbor, Truman wrote Bess that the Russians were as untrustworthy as Hitler and Al Capone. Like Churchill, Truman was more inclined than Roosevelt to view both the Germans and the Russians through the lens of balance of power politics. Throughout his life, Truman was prone in private to use crude anti-Semitic language that belied his growth as a national figure. To the private Truman, New York City was Kike Town, and greedy poker players screamed like a Jewish merchant. He said this although one such merchant, Eddie Jacobson, was his old haberdashery partner in Kansas City and a lifelong friend. Despite his social anti-Semitism, Truman was way ahead of Roosevelt in speaking out against Hitler's war on the Jews. In April 1943, he spoke to a Chicago rally chaired by Rabbi Wise. Truman said, "We must do all that is humanly possible to provide a haven and place of safety for all those who can be grasped from the hands of the Nazi butchers." He told the crowd that Hitler's war against the Jews was not a Jewish problem, but an American problem. During World War II, Truman made his national reputation with his Senate investigation of the U.S. defense effort. The Truman Committee revealed how pre-war collaboration between American big business and German cartels may have undermined U.S. preparedness. Truman was a president with Confederate ancestors. Privately, he compared the job to be done now in defeated Germany to the Reconstruction that had been so hard on the American South. He said, "You can't be vindictive after a war." He said, "I know what it means to lose." He recalled, "My own family was on the losing side in the Civil War. I remember my grandmother telling me stories about the Yankee Redlegs who raided her farm and shot her chickens and butchered her pigs and set fire to the hay and the barns." He recalled, "My mother hated the Yankees till she died, and I didn't want hate to be this war's gift to the future." Morgenthau and others in the cabinet were still haggling over the final version of JCS 1067, the Directive for Postwar Germany. When McCloy flew to Germany in April, he found German cities standing out like so many decayed teeth. He realized that soon Germany would be starving. On his return, he told Stimson that slaves from the surrounding nations, whom Germans had been working to death, were now being released by the U.S. Army and running riot through the country. Fortified by McCloy's bleak report, Stimson and his men defended the loopholes that McCloy had sewn into JCS 1067. Assistant Secretary of War Robert Lovett said that plants, equipment, and other industrial treasure should not be taken from Germany unless the U.S. commander attested that they were not needed for the support and protection of the occupying forces. Morgenthau did not want 1067 to let the Allied Control Council allow wages and prices to be managed by German authorities. He reminded the others that Roosevelt had been very clear in saying that the German economy should seek its own level. But Assistant Secretary of State Will Clayton replied that if German inflation raced out of control, it would exhaust the German food supply and the U.S. Army would have to act. McCloy said, "We don't think we're going to stop inflation in Germany, but Americans will be blamed for whatever inflation takes place." He said, "Give the American zone commander the authority to do what he feels he may have to do." McCloy wrote Truman that Germany was in desperate need of food, fuel, and transportation. He said, "There is complete economic, social, and political collapse in Central Europe. The extent has been unparalleled in history, unless one goes back to the collapse of the Roman Empire." McCloy said, "Even the Roman Empire may not have experienced so great an economic upheaval." McCloy gave the president a draft of 1067 at the end of April. Truman promised to read every word of it. He said, "I have read a million words since I became president, and I am ready to read another million." Truman agreed with Stimson and McCloy that crippling German industry, and therefore food production, would penalize the other Europeans who had been Hitler's victims. He said he wanted Europe to be rehabilitated by the people who had destroyed it. McCloy told Morgenthau that the U.S. Army was now using German synthetic oil and rubber plants to very great advantage. Morgenthau was shocked. He said, I don't see why they just pick on oil. Let's just start rebuilding the whole of Germany. He asked Stimson and McCloy whether they were going to destroy Germany's war-making enterprises or find excuses not to destroy them. Stimson said that no one disagreed about removing the German synthetic oil industry as an integral part of Germany's war potential. The only question was timing. He took the matter to the president, who backed him up. Stimson wrote in his diary, "Morgenthau is afraid that the least little bit of his scorched earth policy toward Germany will be relaxed. I foresee hideous results from his influence in the near future." Morgenthau suffered defeat after defeat, but he still imagined that Truman might endorse his plan for Germany. In the Oval Office, he gave Truman an article he had written for newspaper publication after VE Day. A few days later, Truman told him that he had read his piece the night before and that his portrait of a dangerous resurgent Germany had kept him awake for 2 hours. He reminded Morgenthau that he, Stalin, and Churchill hadn't yet agreed about Germany. Of Morgenthau's article, Truman said, "I like everything that's in there, but it's up to me to say that." On Wednesday, May 9, one day after victory in Europe, Morgenthau complained to Truman that Stimson's people were holding up JCS 1067. He said it was important to get 1067 out now, while Americans were still aroused over the German atrocities. Truman said, "I will stick a pin into them." Morgenthau gave Truman the sequel to the article on post-war Germany that the president had asked him to quash. Morgenthau said, "I realize you don't want me to publish this thing. I've accepted your decision." Truman said, "I couldn't explain it to you fully, but you put all your cards on the table, and I will put all my cards on the table. I've got to see Stalin and Churchill, and when I do, I want all the bargaining power, all the cards in my hand, and the plan on Germany is one of them." Pulling out a map of German food production and population, Truman said, "I just wanted to show you that I'm studying this myself." Morgenthau said, "I got the impression that you liked my plan." With the imprecision of a politician, Truman said, "By and large, I am for it." Morgenthau leafed through his manuscript. He said, "Here's the part on agriculture." He showed Truman a chart showing that Germany was not crucial to feeding Europe. Truman said, "That's contrary to what everyone has told me." Now Morgenthau had another idea. He asked Truman, "Why don't you use me on the Russian situation?" Disinclined to offend Morgenthau by turning him down flat, Truman replied carefully. He said, "I will use all the tools I can lay my hands on." Wearing rose-colored glasses, Morgenthau wrote in his diary of his distinct feeling that Truman likes me and has confidence in me, and I must say that my confidence in him continues to grow. The next day, Truman signed JCS 1067. The directive ordered the American commander in Germany to show the conquered Germans that their ruthless warfare and fanatical Nazi resistance had made chaos and suffering inevitable. It said the Germans cannot escape responsibility for what they have brought upon themselves. It said they must be denazified, demilitarized, and re-educated. The president also approved Roosevelt's old recommendation that reparations from Germany not promote or require the building up of German economic capacity. He said these should be taken as much as possible from German national wealth at the time of surrender. He said they should fall equitably on each of the occupation zones. Eisenhower pleaded with Truman not to make 1067 public. He warned him that publication would cause considerable confusion and embarrassment with the British. The British thought the directive was much too harsh. For that reason, Truman agreed. Another reason was that he was wary of alienating the defeated Germans by releasing a militant directive just at the time when the Anglo-Americans were competing with the Russians for German allegiance. Morgenthau chose to overlook the loopholes that McCloy had inserted in 1067. He told his staff that Truman's endorsement was a big day for the Treasury. He just hoped that somebody doesn't recognize it as the Morgenthau plan. He wrote his sons that 1067 was plenty tough. He said, "If it is carried out in the spirit in which it is conceived, I don't see how Germany can rise to make war again for at least another 50 years. On Friday, May 11, Churchill renewed his demand that Truman not withdraw U.S. troops from the Soviet zone until they were satisfied with Soviet behavior, especially on Poland. Churchill wrote Truman, "Terrible things have happened during the Russian advance through Germany to the Elbe. There were numerous reports of Red Army brutality, including the pillage of German houses and the rape of almost 2 million German women." In a later message to Truman, Churchill attacked JCS 1067. He said that it may seem that the Anglo-Americans were distracted by inflicting severities on Germany, which is ruined and prostrate. The result might be to give the Soviets the opening to advance, if they choose, to the waters of the North Sea and the Atlantic. Churchill implored Eisenhower not to dissolve his joint British-American command, which would remove still another constraint against the Soviets. He also felt that the Allied Control Commission in Berlin should not be activated until the West had solved some of its differences with Moscow. In Washington, Stimson disagreed. He told Truman, "This is the time to put up with a good bit of ill-mannered behavior with the Russians in a sincere attempt to maintain a relationship." With that advice, Truman agreed to send Eisenhower to Berlin. There, the Americans, British, Soviets, and French were to sign a formal declaration of victory and work out plans for the Control Council. On Wednesday, May 16, Truman saw Morgenthau again in the Oval Office. He said he had read Morgenthau's second article on Germany and would ask Eisenhower to tell whether it should be published. He knew, of course, that Eisenhower would say no. Morgenthau told Truman that the French had invited him to open a war bonds exhibit in Paris in early July. He said he wanted to go up the Ruhr and Saar and see what is going on. There is no doubt that Truman was horrified by the idea of Morgenthau performing an encore of the previous summer's now well-known trip to Europe, which had started the public convulsion over the Morgenthau plan. By now, thanks to Nazi propaganda, Morgenthau was probably the most hated American in Germany. The president handled Morgenthau's request with care. Rather than turn him down, he said he didn't object to the trip. He knew he could get someone else to quash it later. Morgenthau told Truman he was disappointed that 1067 had not been made public. He said there had been so many false rumors about how Germany would be treated that a clear-cut presidential statement would ease the minds of many Americans. He said he could have a draft of a speech to him within 24 hours. Truman quickly declined. After Morgenthau left, Stimson came in. He warned Truman that the likely pestilence and famine in Central Europe next winter might be followed by political revolution and communistic infiltration. Stimson wanted the president to send Herbert Hoover, whom he had served as Secretary of State, to Europe. The former president, known for his post-World War I work on European food relief, could assess the current problem. Stimson was worried that Truman might be under Morgenthau's spell. He told Truman it would be a grave mistake to let emotional thinking push Germany near the margin of hunger for past misdeeds. Truman told Stimson not to worry. He later recalled, "Even when I was in the Senate, I opposed the Morgenthau plan. Since entering the White House, I came to feel even more strongly about it." He said years later, "I was never in favor of that crazy plan."
You and I will have to bear great responsibility.
In Moscow on Saturday, May 26, Roosevelt's old aide Harry Hopkins, now working as Truman's envoy, met with Stalin. The Soviet leader recalled Roosevelt's Yalta toast just 3 months earlier to their next meeting in Berlin. Stalin said that, according to his own commanders, Berlin was so devastated that the meeting would have to be in the region of Berlin. Hopkins said he hoped that the Russians would find Hitler's corpse. Stalin said he thought the Führer was not really dead, but hiding somewhere. Stalin said this, but almost certainly he knew that Hitler was dead. According to Soviet evidence released in the 1990s, the Russians had discovered the charred corpses of Hitler and Eva Braun on May 4, 1945. Hopkins asked Stalin whether he still felt that Germany should be dismembered. Stalin claimed that the Americans and British at Yalta had thought of partition of Germany merely as a threat to hold over the Germans' head in the event of bad behavior, to which the Soviet Union had finally agreed. Hopkins reported that Truman was inclined toward putting the Ruhr, Saar, and West Bank of the Rhine under international control. Stalin predicted that Churchill would never agree to this, but as for himself, he had an open mind. U.S. Ambassador Averell Harriman asked Stalin whether food from the Soviet zone might be traded for coal from the British and American zones. Puckishly, Stalin said such a deal would be most difficult. He said the Germans in his zone had all fled to Berlin, hoping to find better conditions. Instead, he said, they should all help the Germans re-establish farming and light industry to live within their own means. Hopkins proposed a Big Three conference in the suburbs of Berlin for mid-July 1945. He cabled Truman that Stalin was very anxious to meet you at any time you wish. Alarmed by more Soviet advances, Churchill cabled Truman that mid-July would be much too late for the urgent questions that demand attention between us. He noted that he himself was in the midst of a hotly contested election, but he would put the Big Three meeting first. But, citing the demands of Congress, Truman replied that July 15 was the earliest date he could manage to leave Washington. Once again, Churchill begged Truman not to withdraw the U.S. Army from the whole center and heart of Germany. He warned, "Such an action will bring Soviet power into the heart of Western Europe and the descent of an iron curtain between us and everything to the eastward." He told Truman, "You and I will have to bear a great responsibility for the future." At the White House on Friday, June 1, Morgenthau saw Truman again. He said, "I don't know if you want to hear some gossip, but the talk around town is that you're going to put Stettinius out." Morgenthau said he had heard that the new Secretary of State would be James Burns. Burns had been Franklin Roosevelt's chief war mobilizer. Morgenthau said, "So that you completely understand me, I can't get along with Burns." Morgenthau had heard correctly, but Truman was not yet ready to announce Burns's appointment. Instead, Truman told Morgenthau that leading Democrats were thinking it was dangerous, in case anything should happen to me, for him to be succeeded by a Republican like Stettinius. At that time, before the passage of the 22nd Amendment, the Secretary of State was next in line of presidential succession. After that would have been the Secretary of the Treasury and other cabinet members. Later that day, without reference to Morgenthau, Truman wrote in his diary, "The Jews claim God Almighty picked them out for special privilege. Well, I'm sure he had better judgment." On Tuesday, June 5, Eisenhower met at the Berlin Yacht Club with his three Allied counterparts. From France came Maréchal Jean de Lattre de Tassigny, from England came Field Marshal Sir Bernard Law Montgomery, and from Russia came Marshal Georgi Zhukov. The Berlin Yacht Club had somehow survived Allied bombing. There, the four men were to sign papers creating the Allied Control Council as the supreme governing authority in Germany. By surprise, Zhukov insisted that they wait until each power withdrew its armed forces to its own zone and the Soviets were acquainted firsthand with problems in the Soviet zone. He added that until those withdrawals began, the Red Army would deny the other Allies access to their assigned sectors of Berlin. Eisenhower and his new deputy, Lucius Clay, were astounded by Zhukov's obstinance. Clay cautioned Washington that if Zhukov's display was any harbinger, the Control Council might wind up as nothing more than a negotiating agency. Amid the growing chill, the Americans nervously noted that Berlin was 110 miles inside the Soviet zone. They also noted that the Russians had still offered no formal guarantee of access. On his way home from Moscow, Hopkins stopped to see Eisenhower at Frankfurt. After their talk, Hopkins cabled Truman that U.S. withdrawal from the Soviet zone should be linked to a Soviet guarantee of unrestricted access to Berlin over agreed-upon routes. By cable, Truman suggested to Stalin that withdrawal coincide with movement of Allied garrisons into Berlin and provision of free access for U.S. forces by air, road, and rail from Frankfurt and Bremen. But unwilling to renege on what he considered a U.S. commitment, the president would go no further. He reminded Churchill that prompt withdrawal was required by the Quebec Agreement. Pessimistically, Churchill wrote Truman back, "I sincerely hope that your action will, in the long run, make for a lasting peace in Europe." Churchill and Truman pledged to Stalin that the troop withdrawal would start on June 21, but Stalin asked them to defer the starting date to July 1. He said that until then, Zhukov would be gone from Berlin, leading a victory parade in Moscow. He also said that not all the districts of Berlin had been cleared of mines. Stalin proposed that the Big Three meeting be in mid-July and convene at the palace of the German Crown Prince in Potsdam. Potsdam was in the Soviet zone, just outside Berlin. Churchill and Truman agreed. Morgenthau was still eager to make his victory tour of liberated Europe, but as he sadly wrote in his diary, he was confronting a stone wall in Truman. Still, he did not retreat. On Monday, June 18, Truman told aides that Morgenthau had no business being in Europe with the Big Three conference coming on. He said, "Morgenthau will be mad as hell, but he'll just have to be." Truman called in Morgenthau. He told him, "You know, I feel like a brother to you, and I wish you could feel that way towards me." He said that after thinking about Morgenthau's proposed trip, he thought that since Morgenthau was the next ranking cabinet member after the Secretary of State, he shouldn't be out of Washington while the President and Secretary of State were in Europe. Morgenthau told Truman that when Mr. Roosevelt went to Yalta, he had told the cabinet that, "If any emergency arose, I should call the cabinet together." Truman said, "That's so. I want you to be here. You're the ranking man by law." Morgenthau was unable or unwilling to detect Truman's unease with him. He proudly wrote his sons about Truman's comment that he felt like a brother to him. Morgenthau said, "That gives you some idea as to how we are getting along." During a long weekend at Highhold, his country estate, Stimson was preparing his crowning assault on the Morgenthau plan. McCloy's brother-in-law, Lewis Douglas, now working for General Clay in Frankfurt, had sent him a somber description of the dangers posed by the German coal shortage. Stimson wrote in his diary that on the German question, he was confronting the zeal of the Jewish American statesman seeking vengeance. Bernard Baruch, the Wall Street tycoon, self-styled advisor to presidents, and a non-practicing Jew, was also demanding a more punitive approach to Germany. Truman had invited McCloy to Potsdam, but not Stimson. Truman may have feared that because Churchill and Stalin were not bringing their war ministers to Potsdam, it might strike Stalin as unduly militant or even anti-Soviet, to include Stimson. Finally, on Monday, July 2, the usually diffident Stimson raised the matter with Truman. The president was scheduled to leave for Potsdam in 4 days. Truman promised to think about taking Stimson to the meeting. The next day, Truman watched James Burns sworn in as his new Secretary of State in the White House Rose Garden. The previous summer, before the Chicago Democratic Convention, Truman had agreed to Burns' request that he nominate him for vice president. But when told that Roosevelt's choice was not Burns but Truman, a red-faced Truman had had to ask Burns to release him from his promise. Ever since Chicago, by his own political rulebook, Truman had felt that he owed it to Burns to balance things up. Himself kept in the dark by Roosevelt about Yalta, Truman was impressed that the late president had seemed to take Burns into his confidence by including Burns in his party at his final Big Three conference. When people later complained about Burns' lack of foreign policy experience, Truman brought them up short by noting that Burns had been to Yalta. What Truman did not understand was that Roosevelt had taken Burns to Yalta merely as a consolation prize for refusing him the vice presidency, and that to Burns' surly annoyance, Roosevelt had banned Burns from more than one meeting with Churchill and Stalin. Stimson was delighted that Burns would now be Secretary of State. He knew that Burns' views on Germany, as he wrote, clicked entirely with his own. He could rely on Burns to help him cut out Morgenthau, whom they both disdained, from future deliberations over Germany. In the Oval Office on Tuesday afternoon, July 3, Stimson had a heart-to-heart talk with Truman about Germany. He warned that Germany would be the biggest occupation and the biggest rehabilitation problem America had ever faced. He said, of course, Nazi war criminals must be punished, but Americans must avoid vengeance. He said, when you punish your dog, you don't keep souring on him all day after the punishment is over. Truman said he felt exactly the same way. Stimson went on. He carped about what he called the problem of our Jewish people here. He described Morgenthau's interventions with Roosevelt and Churchill in Quebec. Truman chuckled. He said he had heard about that. Stimson warned Truman against Baruch's demand for harsher treatment of Germany. Stimson said, the danger is not yet over. Truman said, the Jews are all alike. They can't keep themselves from meddling in the German question. Stimson proposed that from now on, Truman should ignore the Treasury on Germany. Let the new Secretary of State refine the policy and then implement it. Truman agreed. He invited Stimson to the Big Three conference. He also made him a promise. He said, don't worry, neither Morgenthau nor Baruch nor any of the Jew boys will be going to Potsdam.
How I hate this trip.
On Thursday morning, July 5, 1945, the day before Truman left for Potsdam, Morgenthau went to the Oval Office in an angry mood. He was indignant about Burns' appointment as Secretary of State, and he was anxious about rumors that he would be the next cabinet member sacked. Morgenthau told Truman, "The last time I was here, you said you felt like a brother to me. I would like to reciprocate that feeling and have an official family talk. You're leaving for Potsdam, and there is all this gossip about my being through." Truman said, "Oh, I'm going to say you're the man in charge while I'm gone." Morgenthau drew the line in the sand. "I would like to know now whether you want me to stay until VJ Day." Truman said, "I don't know. I may want a new Secretary of the Treasury." Morgenthau was staggered and hurt. He replied, "Well, Mr. President, if you have any doubts in your mind, after my record of 12 years here, and after several months with you, when I've given my loyal support, you ought to know your mind now. And if you don't know it, I want to get out now." Truman said, "Let me think this thing over." Morgenthau refused. He said, "Either you want me to stay until VJ Day, or you don't. I don't think it's conceited to say that I'm at least as good or better as some of the five new people you appointed in the cabinet, and on some of them I think you definitely made a mistake." Morgenthau went on, "I'm going to write you a letter of resignation. Would you like me to stay while you're abroad, or would you like to have it take effect immediately?" Truman said, "You're rushing it." The president suggested that for now he tell the public that Morgenthau was staying, then after Potsdam he could announce his resignation. There was a reason why Truman wanted Morgenthau to remain at his post until after the Big Three meeting. Truman's preferred candidate for Morgenthau's successor, former Congressman Fred Vinson of Kentucky, was going to Potsdam. For this reason, Morgenthau agreed to stay at Treasury until Truman returned to Washington, but he said he wanted his resignation announced that very evening. Otherwise, he said, "I will be forced to give it out tomorrow, and I wouldn't like to do that while you're on the high seas." Truman consented. Morgenthau complained that no one from Treasury was going to Potsdam. He said, "We have information that nobody else has." He said, "Would the president like a copy of the Morgenthau plan to take with him?" Truman said, "I know everything that's in it." With no conviction, he added, "I think it's very good." Morgenthau was thunderstruck by his confrontation with Truman. He returned to the Treasury. He told Harry Dexter White and his staff, "I couldn't hold my head up and have this man say to me he was uncertain about me." He said, "It's been a good 12 years, and we've worked hard." Years later, Truman privately gave his own more boastful version of his confrontation with Morgenthau. Truman said, "When the trip to Potsdam was being arranged, Morgenthau came to see me and said he had to go along. I said, 'I don't need you, and it's not your business.' Morgenthau said, 'If I can't go to Potsdam, what's going to happen to the Morgenthau plan?' I said they could throw it out the window. Morgenthau pouted and said he would quit. I said, 'All right, I accept your resignation right now.'" Truman went on to recall that Morgenthau's plan, as he said, wasn't worth a hoot. Truman said, "Hitler's treatment of the Jews is what pushed Morgenthau forward." He said, "There's not enough land in all of Central Europe to feed Germany's 80 million people in a first-class manner. Half of them would starve to death." Truman said, "I don't think Roosevelt was ever sold on the Morgenthau plan, which was really to enslave the German people. Morgenthau wanted to put an iron heel on Germany's neck." In the years after Morgenthau's departure, Truman privately told cronies that Roosevelt's old friend was a nut and a blockhead who didn't know shit from apple butter. On Thursday afternoon, Truman told reporters that Morgenthau would leave the Treasury after Potsdam. But the next day, he heard complaints that if his boat sank in the Atlantic with himself and Burns aboard, he would be succeeded by an unelected Jewish president poised to enact his vindictive plan against Germany. Therefore, Truman turned to Sam Rosenman, a Roosevelt holdover and now his highest-ranking Jewish aide. He told Rosenman he had been under pressure all day to immediately remove Morgenthau from the line of presidential succession. He said that Fred Vinson would be pulled off the boat to Potsdam so that his name could be sent at once to the Senate. He told Rosenman to give the bad news to Morgenthau. The following Monday, Rosenman went to see Morgenthau. He said he was embarrassed by his mission, but the president had realized that it would be quite a while until he returned from Potsdam. The president had found people very much worried about the succession. Rosenman said he didn't know whether Morgenthau wanted to remain in Truman's good graces, but it would make the president very happy if Morgenthau departed the Treasury immediately. Rosenman added, wholly on my own, that if Morgenthau went quietly, Truman might appoint him as governor of the New World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Harry Dexter White and other aides urged their boss to accept Rosenman's offer. Morgenthau pledged to think about it, but he shrewdly predicted that Burns and Vinson would oppose him. He drafted three letters for Truman's signature and sent them for approval to the president, who was on his way to Potsdam. The first letter was Morgenthau's request to resign immediately. The second was Truman's reply, lauding Morgenthau's keen sense of public responsibility. The third, as Morgenthau said, was designed to smoke the president out. That letter would be Truman's offer of the fund and the bank. As Morgenthau predicted, the president approved only the first two letters. As a result, Morgenthau left office as the longest-serving Treasury Secretary since Albert Gallatin's 13 years under Presidents Jefferson and Madison. Despite his forced bravado, Morgenthau felt publicly humiliated by the abrupt way that Truman had aborted his public service. His aide Henrietta Klotz recalled that when Fred Vinson was sworn in as Secretary of the Treasury, the very unhappy Morgenthau stood alone in the corner and nobody went over to him. Klotz recalled that Morgenthau looked like a lost sheep. She said, "It broke my heart." U.S. Treasury trucks took Morgenthau's hundreds of boxes of papers and belongings north to his farm in Dutchess County, New York. That fall, the former secretary published his volume on the Morgenthau Plan under the title, "Germany is Our Problem." While completing the book, he asked Churchill for permission to publish the still-secret memo endorsing a pastoral Germany that Churchill had dictated at Quebec and Roosevelt had initialed along with Churchill. But Churchill pleaded with Morgenthau by cable not to reveal the memo. He noted that the world situation had changed in many respects. Churchill did not add that it would also be politically embarrassing to him. In retirement, Morgenthau was chagrined to receive almost none of the job offers that would normally come to a newly resigned Treasury Secretary. Few on Wall Street wanted any part of the New Deal maverick. The once indifferent Jew was asked to be general chairman of the United Jewish Appeal. Morgenthau accepted. As his son Henry III recalled, it was a perfect match. Henry wrote, "He needed the respect and love that the Jewish community was ready to offer him, and they, in turn, needed his stamp of ecumenical respectability." Henrietta Klotz recalled that after a while, her old boss even became kind of a little Jewish. By then, Klotz felt free to tell him about a ruse she had abetted in 1943 while trying to prod him to save Jews from Hitler. During a Treasury meeting, Morgenthau had been deeply upset when Rabbi Abraham Kalmanowitz, pleading with him to help the Jews, fell to the floor in a faint. Klotz, who understood Yiddish, heard the rabbi mutter in Yiddish to his translator, "Well, did I cry well?" Klotz had never told her boss that Kalmanowitz's collapse was feigned. She feared that if I told it to him, he'd never let another rabbi in. By 1948, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., the old 100% American, had become a Zionist. With tears in his eyes, Morgenthau toured the new state of Israel as it fought for independence. Braving mortar shells and small arms fire, he declared that without a Jewish Jerusalem, Israel would be like the Jewish people without its history. He praised Israeli troops for showing the world that the Jew is a fighting man. The Israeli foreign minister, Levi Eshkol, clearly ignorant of the Morgenthau plan and its reception in Germany, told Morgenthau that since he was Jewish and of German extraction, wouldn't he be well suited to help Israel win $120 million in reparations from Germany? Morgenthau gently explained that his influence would not exactly be helpful in Germany. He said the seeds that Joseph Goebbels sowed about Roosevelt and me are still fresh in the minds of the Germans. Besides, he said he was resolved never to set foot in that country. After Eleanor Morgenthau's death in 1949, Morgenthau married Marcel Puthon Hirsch, a French Catholic divorced from a prosperous French Jew. With thick glasses and bleached blonde hair, the new Mrs. Morgenthau garishly redecorated his New York apartment and nudged her husband away from Jewish charities. With sadness, Henry Morgenthau III recalled that at the end of his life, troubled by his misalliance, my father cut himself off from almost everybody. Henrietta Klotz recalled, he was so unhappy. She was cruel, common and cruel. Until his death in 1967, Morgenthau never relaxed his intense faith in his tough plan for post-war Germany. While working on Morgenthau's authorized biography, the young Yale historian John Morton Blum told Morgenthau he thought the plan had been a mistake. Blum's comment annoyed the old man. Morgenthau said, "You're too young to know whether the Morgenthau plan was a mistake, and I'll bet you, though I won't be around to collect, that you're going to have to fight Germany again before you die." In Washington, on Friday evening, July 6, 1945, Harry Truman boarded the presidential train for Newport News, where the heavy cruiser Augusta waited to take him and his party across the Atlantic. Truman wrote his wife Bess that he felt as blue as indigo about seeing Mr. Russia and Mr. Great Britain. He told his diary, "How I hate this trip, but I have to make it." During the 8-day voyage, Truman's spirits brightened. He took early morning constitutionals down the Augusta's deck. He carried a metal tray through chow lines. He watched sailors in firing practice, and he gazed through binoculars at the ocean. At night, he dined to the music of what he called a fine band. He played poker with his aides and watched films. One of these was Something for the Boys, starring the fruit-adorned Carmen Miranda. "A most restful and satisfactory trip," Truman wrote Bess. "Haven't been sick a minute." Under balmy skies, Truman sat in deck chairs with Burns, Admiral Leahy, the Soviet expert Charles Bolin, and others who had advised Roosevelt at Casablanca, Tehran, Quebec, and Yalta. Truman recalled in 1954 that after reading Stalin's final cables to Roosevelt, he had felt on guard. But as he recalled, he still had the kindliest feelings in the world toward Russia. He said they had lost 7 million men in the field, besides all the civilians the Germans had killed. I hoped all the time that the Russians would live up to their agreements. Truman told his advisors that he would listen to any suggestion made at Potsdam for a partition of Germany, but not Morgenthau's proposals. Those, he said, were out. From Brussels, Truman and his party boarded Roosevelt's old plane, the Sacred Cow, and two other C-54s for Berlin. From his window seat, Truman had his first glimpse of the defeated nation. He was told that in the Soviet zone, Red Army soldiers had torn up the factories and taken everything out of them. The presidential party was driven to the Babelsberg neighborhood of Potsdam. Once it had been a summer retreat for German film stars and producers. There Truman was lodged in a yellow stucco villa by a lake, which he found so gloomy that he called it the Nightmare House. In his diary, he noted that the Red Army had stripped the villa. Not even a tin spoon left. The Americans were told by the Russians that the mansion had belonged to a German film mogul who had been sent to a Siberian labor battalion. But after Truman published his memoirs in 1955, Gustav Müller-Grote, son of the owner, wrote the former president that the Russians had lied. He wrote, 10 weeks before you entered this house, its tenants were living in constant fright and fear. By day and by night, plundering Russian soldiers went in and out, raping my sisters before their own parents and children, beating up my old parents. During Truman's residence in their house, the Müller-Grote family was, unbeknownst to the Americans, under Soviet detention in a building just 500 yards away. Truman had never met Churchill before Potsdam. He recorded that when the Prime Minister called on him at his villa on Monday morning, July 16, Churchill, quote, gave me a lot of hooey about how great my country is and how he loved Roosevelt and how he intended to love me. As Truman recalled in 1954, I liked him from the start. I think he was surprised and pleased when he met me. Of course he had been informed of what an inadequate chief of state he had to deal with, but I think he changed his mind. Truman was told that Stalin would be late in reaching Potsdam. With time on his hands, the president decided to tour Berlin. The sight of defeated Germans and their victims reminded Truman once again of his Confederate grandmother and her family after the Civil War. He later recalled, forced off the farm by Yankee laws, they had wandered for weeks along the hot Missouri roads until they found a safe place to stay. Truman now thought of the millions of people who were like her in Europe now. Touring the ruins of Berlin, Truman smelled the stench of rotting corpses. He saw what was left of the blackened Reichstag. He said, "It's a terrible thing, but the Germans have brought it on themselves." Truman imagined what a victorious Hitler might have done to Washington, D.C., had he been successful. Truman felt thankful that Americans had been spared the devastation. Truman and his party pulled up at Hitler's chancellery near the underground bunker. Truman refused to go in. He said he wouldn't want any of those unfortunate Germans to think he was gloating over them. In his diary, Truman wrote that the absolute ruin of Berlin was Hitler's folly. He wrote, "Hitler overreached himself by trying to take in too much territory. He had no morals, and his people backed him up."